I am Robert Castanello, an assistant professor of history at the University of Central Florida, and you are listening to the Riches Documentary Podcast. In this episode, I sat down with author Gilbert King, who recently published a book on the Groveland Four titled The Devil in the Grove. He wrote a detailed history of this seminal event in the history of civil rights in Central Florida. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Hi, I'm Robert Castanello, an assistant professor of history at the University of Central Florida. And today I'm joined by Gilbert King, who's a historian and just completed a book called The Devil in the Grove, which is a history of the Groveland Four and the work of Thurgood Marshall in prosecuting the case of the Groveland Four. Gilbert, I'd like to thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Robert.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you got onto this research in the first place?
Sure. I was working on my past book, which was called The Execution of Willie Francis, and it was a case about a young 16-year-old boy who was convicted of murder, sent to the electric chair, and the electric chair did not work. The executioners were drunk at the time, and they didn't hook it up properly. And so Willie Francis survived his own execution, and they didn't quite know what to do with him, and it became a very big Supreme Court case in the late 40s. And as I was looking through a lot of Supreme Court records, I came across Thurgood Marshall's involvement in this case and how he was sort of handling the publicity and handling the strategy, even though he wasn't representing this kid. And I just was very impressed with the things that he was doing. He was very much about controlling the media and doing things public relations-wise that were sort of ahead of his time, I thought. And so I started looking through more and more of Marshall's work, and I came across this Groveland case, which was the same thing, ultimately. He was doing a lot of work behind the scenes, political channels, celebrities, religious channels, to sort of save the lives of, you know, condemned men. And as I started looking more and more into this case, I thought, wow, this is beyond that. This is a pretty dramatic story.
Can you tell us some of the hurdles you went through? I mean, how many libraries, archives you have to go through? What kind of papers did you have to research?
Sure. Well, you know, it's a very extensive project because there was papers all over the country. There was the Florida State Archives, the governor's records at the University of South Florida. I was doing a lot of work in the Library of Congress, looking at the NAACP records and also Supreme Court records. And ultimately, I ended up looking at the Legal Defense Fund files, which really hadn't been looked at in quite a long time. And so there was files all over the country. Even some of the Howard University had some. In New York, there were some documents at Columbia University. So I was just really following these trails and see where they would lead.
And as I understand it, you were able to find documents that had never been seen by scholars or journalists.
Right.
Can you tell me a little bit about how that helped to form the opinion you had of the Groveland Four case?
Yeah, that was an important moment because the NAACP has these Legal Defense Fund files, which are basically the lawyer's notes and all the records for the law cases. And since Thurgood Marshall died, these records really hadn't been looked at. A lot of scholars had tried to get in there, but they're held at the Library of Congress, but they're already documented and sort of cataloged, but they're not ready to be seen by the public. And it's not a public entity or where, you know, you can file a Freedom of Information Act. You really have to get permission from the NAACP, and that took me a couple of years. I think why I was able to get in there was that I had a fairly limited scope. I only wanted to see the Groveland records. I wasn't looking to see all the Brown versus Board and all these, because they required legal vetting. And so the LDF had to send an attorney in there and look at all these records before I got to see them. And that's a very expensive process.
Did this help to give you a different perspective on the Groveland Four than what people wrote about previously?
I think so. I think what it really helped me is that it was sort of like being a fly on the wall within some of the strategy meetings. And there were minutes taken from the meeting with Thurgood and his associate counsel where they were saying, what should we do about this? Maybe we should send them out on a tour and sort of raise publicity. They were really trying to raise money through this case. And they had a lot of different strategies and things that they could do, things that they could borrow from the communists at the same time with the Civil Rights Congress had very effective fundraising moves and publicity campaigns, and they were trying to steal from the communists, but they didn't believe in the whole communist cause, so they were sort of distancing themselves from that, and they said, let's not be seen as part of that group, and it was very political at the time, but they I thought it really opened up a lot of just the behind-the-scenes words that Thurgood Marshall and his counsel were saying to each other, why they couldn't pursue certain strategies. And I thought that was interesting because it really involved all the players within this case.
One of the things I try to impress upon my students is that all documents are not equal. So I'm wondering if you can take us into the process by which you vetted each document or a series of documents as far as its accuracy, what it was telling you and what it wasn't telling you.
Right. You know, and that's the thing. There's a lot of documents in there that are really based on hearsay or opinions, and none of it's really documented. Rumors get put into documents all the time. Well, I think this happened. I think this happened. And you had a lot of speculation. And I didn't really want to get into speculation because, you know, I could use it as a broader scope to say that, you know, one of the attorneys felt that this happened. But you have to really qualify that because they had a lot of rumors coming in on this whole murder rape case. And I found, you know, some instances where they were naming names and they were accusing people of being complicit in these crimes. And to just really put their name into the paper without really, or into the book without really, you know, having anything more than just somebody's rumor or someone's opinion, you have to be very careful with that. And I tried to just sort of use common sense above all else and just sort of, there were certain things that did come up that I knew were documented. They were later reported in the newspapers. And so I could sort of source them and sort of check them and verify them. But a lot of the stuff, especially in the minutes where people are speaking sort of off the record, they know nobody's ever going to see these. They don't realize historians will see them years later. But there's a lot of speculation, and I think you have to be careful with that stuff.
Was there any document that surprised you as far as its accuracy or its lack of accuracy?
There was one particular document that I thought was interesting, and this got get right down to the case. After Willis McCall had shot the two prisoners, Willis McCall had taken a lot of public heat that, you know, maybe this was murder, maybe this wasn't really, these guys had jumped him and tried to escape, maybe it was murder. And it was getting a little bit out of hand in the media. And at one point, I found a document that was a letter sent to Thurgood Marshall by another NAACP attorney in Florida who said that he just met with the assistant district attorney. And the assistant district attorney was accusing the state attorney of being complicit in the murder of these two men. And what Marshall dismissed it immediately. He said, I know exactly who that was, and I know why he did that. He's trying to lessen the impact on McCall by making it a more broader investigation. And at the time, Willis McCall was fighting with the state attorney at the time. So he was really sort of trying to drag the state attorney into the case, you know, in the most immoral way. And so Marshall dismissed it, but he didn't deny that it happened.
Interesting. What advice would you give students? I know a lot of our students really do a great job with research, but then I think the challenge for them is translating that research into a written project. So do you have a process that you go through once you finish your research and you sit down and you're ready to map out a book or article? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I go into it never thinking I'm ever finished with the research, but I do think I'm starting to think constantly about the story that I want to tell and the points that I want to make and how are these documents going to support the points that I'm trying to make. Sometimes the documents are fascinating, but they're so off point and they're not part of the big picture of the story I'm trying to tell. And even though they deserve a footnote somewhere or something, they just don't fit into the story that I'm trying to tell. Or if it's a paper, it's not supporting your main thesis or the points of your report. And so I think the main thing is to sort of stick to the story that you want to tell and don't distract people with a lot of extemporaneous information because it can be really overwhelming. And so just sort of be focused on what your story is and use the documents to support the thing because you have to believe in the story first, I think.
Now, you wrote about the Groveland 4 case, which for us at the University of Central Florida is sort of the history in our backyard. And I wonder, can you set the stage for the Groveland case? Who were the major players? What exactly was at the center of the event here?
Right. Well, it was the middle of July in 1949, and what had happened was a young 17-year-old newlywed went out with her husband, who she'd already been separated from. They went out on a date and a dance in a town called Claremont, and the car broke down after the dance, and there was some kind of altercation. The couple of gentlemen, Walter Irvin and Sam Shepard, had been driving by and saw that there was this car stuck, and they pulled over to help them. There was some kind of altercation. Everybody was drinking. And as the story goes, Willie Padgett was sort of left in a ditch. There was some kind of fight. And when he regained consciousness, he claimed that he saw the car drive off and that his wife had been in that car and she'd been kidnapped. And so that set off a whole firestorm where they reported later on the next morning, Norma Padgett sort of showed up on the side of a road, went into a cafe, and said she'd been kidnapped by four black men. And that started this major manhunt. the deputies came in, rounded up four suspects. Actually, only got to three of the suspects. One of the suspects was smart enough to get out of town, and he fled up into the woods, and he was later shot down by a posse about 2 weeks later. So it was down to the Groveland Three pretty quickly. And basically, it was a 16-year-old boy, Charles Greenlee, and then you had Irvin and Shepard, and they were moved into a trial within about 30 days of the accusations. And it became this very big case about rushing these gentlemen to trial. And the NAACP came down and tried to get a defense, but they couldn't find lawyers. They really only had about 4 or 5 days to prepare a case. And it's a capital case. These gentlemen were going to be sentenced to the electric chair. And it caused a big stir because you had lynch mobs who really wanted to take care of justice before it reached court. And so they showed up at the jail and wanted to try and get the guys out of jail and sort of have this sort of citizen's vengeance. And Sheriff Willis McCall actually prevented a lynching initially and sort of said, I want to see justice handled through the courts. And but after that, it got out of control fairly quickly again.
And can you tell us, for me, I know studying the history of civil rights in Florida, there's always a question of Florida's place with the rest of the South. And there's some historians who make the case that Florida had sort of a moderate track in civil rights history. There's others who say Florida had a more reactionary track. And so if we look at the Groveland Four case as a microcosm, does it suggest that Florida was more moderate or more reactionary to civil rights?
I would probably, it's interesting that you say that. One of the things I found when I started doing research, I came up with this, I found this one report that was looking at the South in terms of civil rights, and they sort of viewed Florida as south of the South. It really wasn't part of the Cotton Belt. It was sort of all these, there was a lot of racial atrocities that were happening below the Mason-Dixon line, and it was sort of seen in this land of surf and sun, and it wasn't part of the South, and it didn't really get on the national radar the way it would have in, say, Mississippi or Alabama. And so it's hard for me to really explain why this was happening, and some of the statistics show that it was more violent. There was a higher per capita lynching rate in Florida than any of the other states in the South. And so it was definitely a violent part. I think part of the problem was it just didn't get onto the national media, onto the radar. And so they sort of, and especially in some of the more rural sections, they flew below the radar, and a lot of things just, they didn't have that scrutiny that you might have gotten in parts of the other parts of the South.
What about the NAACP? How is it that they got involved, and why do they think the Groveland Four case was so important?
Well, the NAACP had pretty strict guidelines because at the time, you know, Thurgood Marshall didn't really want to get bogged down in a lot of criminal cases. There was a lot of, there was housing cases, voting cases, segregation cases, and Marshall believed that a lot of these criminal cases could really bog down the NAACP, and they weren't a legal aid society. They only had so much resources. But they felt that there were three criteria that they really said that they would get involved in a criminal case. The first one, that there had to be some perceived racial injustice, number one. Number two, they felt strongly they only wanted to represent innocent clients. They didn't want to get involved in anything and be embarrassed mid-trial that maybe there, something did happen. So they were very strict about only representing innocent people. And the third thing was that the case had to sort of provide some kind of future precedent. And so they applied these three guidelines, and Groveland fit it perfectly because they thought that here were some gentlemen who were accused of rape with very flimsy evidence. And another big guiding factor was that they were able to raise a lot of money. You can't really go out with housing and get people excited and capture the headlines, but Marshall found out very early in his career that a big trial like this that captured all the black newspapers and eventually the mainstream media, it would bring in a lot of membership, a lot of contributions, and they were able to use this to raise money. And they raised, you know, tens of thousands of dollars based on this criminal case. And so Marshall was smart enough to figure out that even though they were advancing civil rights, they were also raising money. And so that's why they got involved.
What's the Groveland case tell us about Florida at that time and that place, and maybe also about Florida since?
I think one of the main things it shows, and Marshall found this out with Harry T. Moore back in 1943, they had investigated the killing of Willie James Howard, who was a young man who was, I think, a 14 or 15-year-old boy. He was sweeping the floors of a drugstore, and around Christmas time, he had written cards to all the members of the drugstore, all the employees, and one of the recipients of that Christmas card was a 15-year-old girl, a white girl, And she took it to her father. Her father did not like the idea of a black student or a black employee writing a Christmas card. And so this story is very horrible. They picked him up at his house at gunpoint, picked up his father, took him into the woods, bound his hands and feet, and they pointed a gun at him and said, "You can either take a bullet or jump in the Suwannee River." And he started bawling, and he just was afraid of the gun, so he jumped in the river, and he died. And the men who had picked him up told the father, they said, "You know, you have to sign that this was an accident. We're going to go down to the sheriff's, and you sign that affidavit." And he was threatened into signing that his son had died by accident, and, you know, he had to leave town 3 days later. And Thurgood Marshall and Harry T. Moore got involved in this, and they couldn't get any action on the part of the Justice Department. The governor was sort of sympathetic. He said, it sounds horrible, but you have to understand it's going to be the word of one black man against three white men, and that you're probably not even going to get an indictment. And so they were met with this force that they just couldn't. They could, outside of a very small black community, there was nothing they could do. They couldn't force prosecution. They could always defend, but they could never force a prosecution. And I think that's what they ran into in Lake County, the same kind of thing where you could not affect the media and public support. But if you look at it now, the things that are going on, it doesn't really take much. It takes, you know, internet, constant cable television, and you have protest on the street. That stuff wasn't happening back in you know, the 1940s and early 50s of Florida. But now it's happening. You'll see police chiefs step aside. You'll see the FBI pressured very quickly into doing a full investigation. And so in those ways, I think it's very much a different landscape.
And I know you focus a lot on Thurgood Marshall and his work in this case. Why is it that Thurgood Marshall is really a window into understanding this case?
Well, I think what I find fascinating is a lot of people have an understanding of Thurgood Marshall as a Supreme Court justice. And they also see him, they know that he was sort of involved in Brown versus Board. But, you know, Marshall saw himself as a civil rights crusader. And he traveled throughout the South taking these kinds of cases. And I thought it would be just really interesting to look at his life, but instead of doing a broad biography, just to sort of look at his life through the lens of just one criminal case and just to see how he acted. And I think it's sort of a microcosm of his entire career and in ways part of the whole civil rights movement. You see the things that were done, the rallying of forces, how to get people to write letter campaigns, how to do boycotts. You know, he was able to sort of inspire a citrus boycott. There were signs and headlines across the country saying, "Notice Negro blood on your grapefruit." And there was pressure. The New York, the mayor of New York at the time, his wife had gone to vacation in Florida, and she caught a lot of grief and flack in the media. "How can you go down there? Look at what they're doing to the Groveland boys. Look at what they've done to Harry T. Moore. You know, you can't go down there." And he was able to sort of fortify all these forces, and it eventually forced Leroy Collins into acting because he saw all this northern money coming in. And there was a reluctance to get involved if it was perceived as this lawless community in this lawless territory where the Klan might be running free and you had a sheriff that was powerful who could do whatever he wanted. And Collins, to his credit, recognized that, you know, this was going to hurt Florida economically. And so he had to come up with some kind of relief from the situation, which I don't think you would have found in other states.
Well, Gilbert, I'd like to thank you for coming out and talking.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Riches Podcast, and don't forget to join us in March of 2013 when we launch our new podcast series.